Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Here's something we found interesting. We've just read two new terrific novels, and they both feature the fascination in 18th century England with mermaids, or the corpses of what were said to be mermaids, to be accurate, displayed in museums or at parties. It was a real craze, if, of course, not a real mermaid, sometimes the corpse of a monkey with a tail sewn on. But anyway, mermaids are at the heart of Imogen Hermes Gower's debut novel, The Mermaid and Mrs. Hancock. There's a rather dull widower merchant, Jonah Hancock. His ship comes in. Literally, one of his captains brings him the corpse of a mermaid, which people soon pay to see because it has the same siren-like attraction another character has. This is the courtesan, Angelica Neal. Do not call her a whore. She was once kept by a wealthy man, but has fallen on hard times. The book is ultimately about class and gender and race and mermaids. It was a bestseller in the UK, shortlisted for the 2018 Women's Prize for Fiction, recently released in the U.S. And Imogen Hermes Gower joins us from the BBC studios in Bristol. Welcome. Come.
Hi, thank you for having me.
What a delight. And by the way, the other book that mentions a mermaid is Daniel Mason's new Winter Soldier. In it, there's a doctor soldier around the same time who, with other scientists, studies a mermaid that's in a museum. A young Madame Curie, Marie Curie, even shows up in the scene to determine if this is a real mermaid. This was a real craze.
Yeah, it really was. I think mermaids were being exhibited kind of throughout the 18th century. There's loads of newspaper articles and reports and drawings of them and things. People were really into them and wanted them to exist, I guess.
And tell us about that. Why did they want them to exist? We know that these were sailors who were coming home in 16th, 17th, 18th centuries with talks of seeing these mermaids out in the water. They think now that it might have been optical illusions. But why did people want so badly to believe that they existed?
It's kind of a way of populating the void. Like, back then, the greatest kind of expanse that you could explore is the ocean, and you kind of want there to be humanoid creatures or something recognisable in it. So I think, you know, mermaids are an easy answer to that, but I guess nowadays maybe that's slightly replaced by aliens in space.
Yes.
That the unexplored is out there now rather than in the sea, and right. We look for humans there too.
Yeah. Well, and you were first inspired by what may have been the same mermaid mentioned in Daniel Mason's book. I mean, it really did exist, the Fiji mermaid?
Yeah. There's a whole kind of tradition of Fiji mermaids. So the one that I was inspired by is in the British Museum. And I worked there for a while, and it was there that I saw it in the collection and kind of my brain started turning. But I know P.T. Barnum had one that had originally started out being exhibited in coffee houses in London as well. And I know that there are two in regional museums in the UK that were made as a pair, as a male and a female, and they're being reunited this year, I think, in some special exhibition.
And it's not what one would imagine. These were ugly critters.
Yeah.
Because of the way they were actually faked and put together. But can you have a description of the one that you write about? Could you read a little bit of that for us so we get a sense of what people were gawking at?
Sure. Captain Jones eases the canvas away, and at first they cannot think what it is they see. For it is brown and wizened like an apple forgotten at the bottom of the barrel, or like the long-dead rats Mr. Hancock once found bricked up in the kitchen wall, parched and cured by the elements, skin that cracked under the pressure of a thumb. It's the size of an infant, and like an infant its ribcage is delicate and pathetic beneath its parchment skin, and its head is large and its fists are drawn up to its face. But this is as far as the comparison may be extended. For no infant has such fearful claws, and no infant such a snarl with such sharp fangs in it, and no infant's torso ends in the tail of a fish.
It's just a horror, but one that people can't take their eyes off of. And as you've said, it becomes the MacGuffin for you, the object that kind of draws us into this story. This is your debut fiction, but you come to writing through an academic background and working in museums and a student of archaeology?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. So my undergrad, I studied archaeology and anthropology and art history. So I definitely kind of came in from this angle of looking at objects and trying to understand how they could shed light on people's stories, what place they take in people's lives.
Give us some examples of that and how you put that in the book.
I think maybe it manifests quite a lot, I have subsequently been told, in the clothes that people wear, especially the women's clothes, that I really felt that someone like Angelica Neal, this courtesan main character of mine, I studied a lot of 18th century dress to kind of try and understand her, how she would feel in her clothes, this idea that, like, you might unpick the adornments from one dress, all the lace and chenille, and attach it to another one, whether you'd allow your stockings to get holes in them or whether you'd always wear new ones, whether you'd let your corset in and out, your stays in and out as you gained weight or lost it, and do you give your second-hand dresses to your servants, that kind of thing, like... It says something about a person and what their values are and how they live, and I really felt that Angelica expressed herself through her clothing. So that was certainly one of the things.
Well, you treat objects the way you were taught when you worked in museums and studied art history. You were taught not to look at the oil painting directly, but look around it. What's the frame made of? And it sounds like that's how you are approaching your writing. And it feels like this was something that was born when you were a child. And there was another, you know, kind of oddity. Is it Ötzi? How do you pronounce it?
Oh, yeah. Ötzi. That was my first love. Ötzi, the 5,000-year-old mummified corpse that was dug out of a glacier in about 1991, I think. And they must have made a TV documentary about it when I was quite, I would say, between the age of 5 and 7. And I remember watching it and just being completely transfixed and drawing pictures of him over and over. He was a shepherd up in the mountains, and he had with him everything that he needed to live. So he had, like, this quiver of arrows, and he had straw stuffed into his boots to keep his feet warm, and he'd mended his cloak himself. They could tell that he was up there in the mountains for a long time, and he had to be very self-sufficient until he got back to the village and someone else would, you know, fix his stuff and give him new boots. That physical understanding of what it might be like to have been that person in the past, to understand all these tiny details of their life and, I guess, the ephemera of it. That's, I guess, always what I've been interested in. What's the texture of living in that world? You read about armies and battles and laws being passed, but who is it who's bringing in the food or making up the beds? Do these people miss their children? That kind of stuff was what I was always interested in. And I guess there's more space for that in fiction than there is in, say, archaeology, when you do have to be very rigorous and strict with yourself and quite detective-like. That there is, in fiction, this space to play and to imagine.
Well, so this is what happens when an anthropologist takes on fiction, because that's how we feel about the characters. We have all these details about how they do things, how they eat, what their tea sets look like. And that brings us back to Angelica. Again, a courtesan, not, you know, she you know, completely disdains the women of the street. She is not that. But what are you saying about women? There's a brothel with many young women who are sort of being instructed to grow up to be Angelica. What are you saying about what you've discovered in history about women's positions in this time?
I think the more that I researched the book and the more I thought about what is the story here, I kind of realized that what I was doing was, in my mind, I guess, almost a kind of survey of the options for 18th century women. It's very much a world without feminism, where if women try to do well by themselves, it might be at the expense of other women. There is very little sense of solidarity. You kind of pull the ladder up. Like, if you've done okay, you want to continue to protect yourself, and the way you protect yourself is by appealing to men who will protect you in this system that has no structure to protect you on your own as a lone woman. The idea of, I guess, morality and sexual fidelity and that kind of thing becomes actually quite a privileged thing to be able to indulge in. That to be a good person means you are in some way already protected, that you don't have to become a whore or a thief. Mm. You don't have to make those choices because you're not supporting yourself alone. It made me more sympathetic to these women who I think history very easily dismisses as total floozies. That actually they had very little to fall back on except for their bodies and their attractiveness. And, of course, they were using those things.
Just like the mermaids did.
Yeah.
That's Imogen Hermes Gower. Her new book, set in late 18th century England, The Mermaid and Mrs. Hancock. Imogen, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me. That was great.
To read an excerpt of The Mermaid and Mrs. Hancock, or to see pictures of the Fiji mermaid and Imogen's childhood love, Ötzi, the mummy in the glacier, as she said, yes, it's glacier, go to hereandnow.org.